All right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are again. The time has finally come. The premiere has aired. Dom, how are you doing?
I'm pumped. I can't believe this has finally come, but now that it has, I'm jazzed to be here talking about it.
Wow, jazzed. One of the rare times that I've ever heard you this enthusiastic at the beginning of an episode, but I think that
totally... I'm digging deep into my thesaurus here, looking for terms to convey just how excited I am. So you know that it's a good sign.
Well, yeah, I think it is absolutely in order. The premiere, I feel like, has been a consensus hit with everyone that I've been hearing talk about it and seeing tweet about it. Just about every corner of the internet seems to be really excited about the start we got from Winners at War episodes 1 and 2, or just episode 1? Do we have clarity on that yet? All right, we're going to start off on a bad foot here. Do we know if this is 1 or 2 episodes?
Officially 2 episodes, I believe, but both episodes were very good. Dare I say stellar. And I have seen basically unanimous praise for these episodes, which I never thought I would see about anything Survivor-related ever again. But yeah, it seems like the fan base may be unified for this brief window.
Yeah, pretty remarkable. And just, we don't need to spend a ton of time on this, I promise, but I feel like I have heard that it is being categorized as just one episode. So I will, I guess, be framing it in those terms, Dom.
Hey,
you live whatever life you want to live, my friend.
Yes. Good for you. Nobody cares. Let's move swiftly on.
Yes.
But I trust you are in the same camp as seemingly everyone else that I've spoken to about this, in loving this premiere and being more optimistic than, frankly, I may be expected to be coming into the first episode of the season here.
Yeah, that's the thing is, you know, this is a season we've known was in the works for such a long time. All the way back last May, it's been that long since we've been podcasting about this cast and so on. And certainly there was a possibility, I thought, that it would be underwhelming for one reason or another. But genuinely, yeah, seeing this actually in real life still almost doesn't even feel like it's fully sunk in for me yet. I feel like I still haven't even completely grasped just what we have on our hands here in terms of how exciting this is going to be, I think, for a very long time coming. So, yeah, I am extremely excited to get to talk about everything that we got to see play out over these first couple of hours. There's so much to dive into here today. And Dom, I know I was someone who, like, I'm guessing a lot of people hearing this, watched the clip show that aired the week, or not clip show, but highlight reel show, I guess, that aired the week before this season premiere. And at the very end of that, they showed the opening 5 minutes or so from season 40. So this was not completely new content to me here right off the bat, but I believe I saw you tweeting pretty excitedly about this opening montage. So I'd love to hear your thoughts in a bit more detail about how this season got off to in terms of a start here.
Yeah, so to cover all of that, I was also concerned that it was going to be impossible for expectations not to be sky high. And even though Survivor as a franchise had been in the doldrums for the past year between Edge of Extinction and then Island of the Idols, that almost seemed like a thought experiment to see just how low expectations could be coming into this season. And yet expectations were still very high. And if anything, it maybe worked to drag them up still higher, where this was the one thing that could redeem the show in the eyes of most people, was for this season to be as good as possibly advertised. So there was a lot riding on this. And I think just there were so many discussions leading up to this. And because people wanted to distract themselves from how disappointing the show had been in the past year, for the vast majority of fans, all eyes were on season 40. This was the only other Survivor-related thing to talk about, really. And so, you know, we spend hours and hours just breaking up, you know, breaking down every possible nook and cranny of the season, dissecting every morsel of information that we had. I donated far too much money to far too many drafts. We really had to dig deep to come up with concepts for new ones after a certain point. So we exhausted every possible angle we could for the preseason. And so I was worried personally for myself that I might almost be tired of discussing this season once it finally arrived on our doorstep. But now that it's here, I can't wait. I mean, this was everything I hoped it would be and more, basically.
And so,
So given all of that, that opening montage, it would be tough for that to fail, basically. I think it was almost guaranteed to send that frisson of excitement down your neck. But for me, I think everyone has that one moment where it really sunk in that this is a reality and finally happening. For me, it was when that like 20 years ago thing in the Survivor font came onto the Chiron, and then it was like, oh my God, it's here. It's really here. It's finally happening.
Yeah. And not only in that opening montage, but across this entire premiere, I thought they did a really good job weaving in flashbacks from people's initial seasons. And also from other things, like the poker show got shown on primetime CBS. That blew my mind, but
right. Just extracurricular activities being excerpted in the middle of a Survivor episode.
I wouldn't be surprised at this point if stuff from like RHAP makes air.
I honestly would not be shocked. If anyone wants to take a bet on that, you know where to find either of us. But
like, yeah, you know, people beefing over things they said in some podcast interview would at this point wouldn't surprise me. But I thought it was used to really tremendous effect over the course of this whole premiere. It reminded me a lot of what they do on Australian Survivor, much more so in terms of setting up people's backstories and like home life. And giving everyone a kind of little mini highlight reel at some point in the first few episodes. And
yeah, I don't know how keen they would have been to do that of their own accord, but I think Yul really announced his return appearance by forcing them to break the fourth wall in that way, where he is one of the driving strategic forces early on in the season, and the reason for marshalling all of those votes against Kim and against Amber was because of the threat of this poker alliance. And he has said in very detailed notes about the episode that he has released on Twitter, which we'll link in our show notes, and we would strongly recommend anyone go and check out.
We'll try to remember, but you can check out Yul's Twitter if we forget.
Yeah, he's back on Twitter after a six-year absence, finally diving back into social media, which may or may not be a smart decision. We'll stay tuned on that, I suppose. But he said that essentially that was a phantom. No, he was not scared of the Poker Alliance. He thought maybe there's a chance that was like every other social occasion that Survivor alumni find themselves at. Of course, that's a chance for bonding and for pregame strategizing or whatever, but that was not the massive overriding threat hanging over the season that he made it out to be. But it was a convenient excuse to target the people he wanted to target anyway, and to get the people who already felt a little bit left out and confused and just wanting a name to write down on his side for that all-important first vote.
So do you think that were they not forced to kind of break the fourth wall a bit in terms of the poker context and wanting the audience to have some familiarity there, they would have also thus been less inclined to show other kind of stuff from previous seasons or whatever else, for setting up like Michelle, for instance, and her underdog story in Ko-Rong and so forth?
I think it is categorically different, where they can go back into their own archives and find the footage and weave that in however they want. And no one would raise an eyebrow at that. And in fact, that's what they've done, as far as I can tell, for basically every All-Star season they've had. What we haven't had through, you know, All-Stars, Fans versus Favorites, Heroes versus Villains, and so on and so forth, I don't think we've ever had this level of just reference to stuff that's completely outside the show, and as far as I know, outside of CBS's whole purview. So I don't know exactly what the like licensing arrangement is that they had to set up or whatever, but the fact that they're even acknowledging this existing and the idea of pregame alliances in general is really a novelty and maybe a refreshing one, because you think back to the first All-Stars, where you have many of the same people coming back for this season. I think they've learned their lesson, because there you had this pregame deal between Rob and Amber, you know, Lex, Kathy, Big Tom, that defined how the entire game played out and the entire course of, you know, many of those relationships, even after the season. And they felt they just couldn't acknowledge that that was a thing. And so that gets built into this dramatic climax in one episode. But it kind of renders everything that happened before that and a lot of what came afterwards completely obsolete. So I would find it surprising but very refreshing if the cards are basically on the table now when it comes to
if people
entirely unintentional. if people are talking about their pregame alliances, then we'll let them talk about their pregame alliances and we'll show that to the audience.
So I agree that this is an historic degree of pulling back the curtain in that respect. I do wonder, though, if they will be more reluctant when it is not so easily packaged as the Poker Alliance, which is a pretty easy nickname, and, you know, the relationship is right there in the title of this group that we're targeting. We can pull up this 3-second clip of them all playing poker, and the audience can very quickly piece together why Yule is concerned about this group. I think it's a lot more difficult when it is that Rob and Big Tom and Kathy and Lex and whatever, where this is because of some conversation that happened at a barbecue in 2000. You know what I'm saying? Where I wouldn't be surprised if we see pre-gaming stuff on the show when it is easy to present to the audience, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if we do not continue to see nearly this much on an episode by episode basis, I suppose is what I'm getting at.
I would kind of love it though, if we come in here in episode 7 and it's okay, so we bugged the food tent at Hearts of Reality 3 years ago, and this is what they said, people. But yeah, a lot of, you know, the best, juiciest pre-gaming information is necessarily stuff that we just are likely never ever going to know about even. So yeah, they're going to do the best they can with what they're given, and so when they can do something like this, they might be more willing to take that opportunity. But by and large, we're still going to be left piecing together a lot of what happened on day negative whatever, long after the season is all done.
Yeah, well, whether it is the clips of the poker show or from people's first seasons or whatever, I am very excited about their willingness to use even more kind of new editing techniques. I'm sure part of it is just because of it feels good to break up the monotony of, as exciting as any confessionalist can be as a speaker, it is cool to have some kind of like visual stimulation interjected there in a way that we've never really had over the last 20 years. So looking forward, hopefully, to more of that. Another thing that really stood out to me and got me super jazzed, I suppose, Dom, right away, is Jeff Probst, as far as I could tell, was truly excited about being there hosting Survivor for the first time in at least a decade. Like, his level of energy during that opening celebration, and again, I, you know, for him, I'm sure, and not just him, for the entire crew of people that have been there forever, this is a huge, huge moment. Everything has really been building up to this, and of course, this is going to be the most excited he's ever been, probably, on a day one. But at the same time, it really was fun just to see that stark contrast between how Jeff has come across, at least to me, for the last several years, versus him really being like a kid out there again, as far as I could tell. Like, he seemed just as excited to watch how all of this was going to play out as we are.
He really did. And I have always respected Jeff's ability to pretend that he's enjoying whatever corner he has forced himself into. Like, I think back to Blood versus Border or Game Changers, where you had this really motley crew of contestants that they cobbled together. And Jeff made it sound like this was the most natural pairing in the world to have all of these people back. So usually on the surface level, Jeff is able to you know, by whatever he's selling himself. But you dig deeper and you can usually tell which season he is actively enthusiastic about and which ones he feels like he's kind of just going through the motions and looking forward to whatever's on the horizon. And yeah, he really does seem as excited about this as the rest of us appear to be as well.
And I do want to agree with you. Well, I feel like I can kind of tell that Jeff is phoning it in from time to time. He generally does a really good job, I think, as far as any casual fan is concerned, of selling every single moment as thrilling and exciting when it's airing on TV. And we don't give him enough credit for that, because I do think that's really important in keeping Survivor on the air.
Yeah, he absolutely has to do it, and he does it well. I just wish that he didn't forcibly pack that with so much bullshit that he then has to come up with this great sales pitch for.
Yeah, sure. So a couple other things I wanted to flag up as everyone is arriving here on this. It's not even a beach. They're on this little strip of sand surrounded. It's, I guess, a little island, technically, surrounded by water on all sides, as far as I'm concerned at this point. And Jeff tells them, hey, welcome. We're going to do the champagne toast, yada, yada, yada. And right away, he reveals a couple of things that are going to be interesting, I would imagine, in terms of how they impact the way the season is going to play out. First being, as we know, Dom, Our Worst Dreams Have Come True, Edge of Extinction is back on this season, which I thought was noteworthy that they flagged that up right away, because I thought there would be some potential interest in not letting people be aware that that was a thing that was happening until the first person comes back in at the merge. Although upon further review, it did cross my mind that if the reason, at least according to Jeff, that it is back is because certain players who have remained nameless insisted upon some sort of rebuy being there, it would definitely be unfair if certain people knew the whole time that there's definitely some sort of second chance situation in place and the other people didn't.
Yeah, I will point out that, as Mike Boogie famously said, you are allowed to bounce checks on shows like this. And if there are people who are, you know, stamping their feet and demanding that some island of some kind be in place to allow them to return at some point, you can just lie and promise them that and then not deliver once they get there. Like, what are they going to do? Turn around and go home? Are they going to quit? Are they like, you've got them where you want them, and you have the bargaining power here. So, yeah, they can love it or leave it. But
I mean, Mike Boogie got roped into a season being told he was a coach, and then they threw him into the main game.
They just jammed his nose onto the big red Dan button. Yeah. But yeah, so given that Edge of Extinction is in place, I think purity-wise, for however much of that remains while Edge of Extinction is a thing, you have to tell them up front. So I'm glad they did that. We shouldn't yada, yada, yada through all of this, though, because in some of the post-episode stuff that's come out, I would recommend going and reading both Gordon Holmes's blog of the episode and Dalton Ross's, both of which contain a lot of behind-the-scenes tidbits. And there are some pretty interesting ones. So the champagne ceremony at the start apparently was delayed to Jeff's chagrin, because every single person was thinking there was some kind of twist going on, and that, like, are we meant to be looking for idle clues? Is there something like jammed in the flute of the wine glass? Like, what exactly is going on? And he had to level with them and be like, guys, just drink the champagne. All of this could come later. Just this is meant to be a nice little gesture for you. But also that apparently at one of these initial tribals, Jeff was going around asking who is excited about Edge of Extinction, who's glad that it's back, and no one was giving him what he wanted. Like, no one was volunteering that. Even the people who supposedly demanded that something like this be there for them to come back, no one was giving that. So eventually, I think, like, maybe it was Sarah or something chimed in to say, oh, I'm really glad about Edge of Extinction. That's a great way for shameless people to buy themselves some airtime on the season. If there's a controversial twist, just embrace it wholeheartedly. Apparently the initial reception to that was muted at best.
That's very funny. Did we get any tidbits about the early reaction to fire tokens? Because I know Gordon and Dalton were both out there for the first 3 days.
Yeah, general confusion, as far as I can tell. It's going to take a while to process exactly what this means. And also, you don't know how crucial they are before you know how many are in circulation and what the going rate for a fire token is. And it looks like that may take some time to refine, because in the menu that we saw in this episode, I don't know that, like, an idol is going to be the same price as some minor advantage in a future challenge or whatever, or some, like, comfort item for Edge of Extinction. It feels like there should be a little bit of a differential pricing going on there.
Yeah, I would hope that in the future, idols do not cost just one fire token. I would imagine that it will function a lot like it did on the Genius in the form of Garnets, where everyone starts with one, but within the first few weeks, it's pretty clear that, you know, one is not very many, and that we will have a lot more fire tokens in the mix over the course of this season.
I also do hope that we end up with a Genius season 4 style thing where, like, Nick Wilson ends up with 85% of the fire tokens in play completely by accident. But I think for production as well, even they don't have a fully mapped out vision for how fire tokens are going to work yet. So I think everyone is just kind of playing it by ear at this point.
One thing I really liked that I saw brought up in a bunch of different places is, if you take a closer look at the tribal immunity idol, which is a big skull, inside the hollow eyes of the skull are lodged what seem to be two fire tokens. So it should be a lot of fun to see someone eventually stumble onto that and pick up two fire tokens for free.
Yeah, and this cast, you know, is going to think outside every conceivable box when it comes to looking for twists, looking for advantages. Again, one of those behind-the-scenes tidbits is that at Tribal, people were, like, getting up there, writing their votes down very quickly, and then looking around the voting booth to see if there was anything, you know, hidden away surreptitiously. So, you know, if there was something out there, someone is going to find it and find a way to maximize it.
One of the notes I have from much later on in this episode is I thought it was very smart of Ben Dreebergen. Hey, here we are, Dom. 2020 is a new year. Let's say nice things about Ben Dreebergen. When he goes up to cast his vote, he lifts up the paperweight that holds down the parchment and very deliberately looks under it for like some sort of idol or idol clue, which is right. A heads up play, I would say.
Yeah, and I'm sure he will continue in that vein, impressing people for the rest of the season now.
Yeah, and that is our regular Ben Dreebergen positivity segment that we are very famous for, and I'm sure we will return to in the not-too-distant future.
There are absolutely no actuaries, for example, at home grinding their teeth over the events of this episode. Nothing like that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. That was definitely... We'll get there. We'll talk more about Ben a little later, but yeah... Must have been pretty frustrating to be Chrissy, to say the least. So the other thing that we get to right away here, while we are still at the very beginning of the season, about 15 minutes in, at least on TV time, we are hitting our first challenge. And normally, when there is a challenge right away, which is pretty rare, I would say, it is almost never for immunity, if literally ever for immunity. There's some fire reward or something, some food or whatever that you can get right away, camp supplies, things of that nature. And I'm sure historians out there can correct me if this is wrong, but this is the only time I can remember immunity being up for grabs this quickly. And I gotta say, I love this so much. Assuming they knew they had to have this kind of accelerated production schedule, where I'm pretty sure, Dom, the first two boots are already out of the game by day three. I think Amber was voted out on like day three, maybe mm-hmm. day four. So with that in mind, I think it is, if you are the producers, borderline mandatory, if you want to make this as good as it can be, to give them the full day and a half to know that they are going to Tribal Council, as opposed to the half a day you would give them under any other circumstance.
Yeah, it's a necessary correction. If you don't do that, then I think something has gone pretty wrong there. You always hear people complain about like the night one evictions on Big Brother or whatever, and this would effectively be Survivor's form of that.
Yeah. So did you have any thoughts on this first challenge? I didn't even write down what kind of... I know that it at least began in the water, and I'm guessing ended in either a puzzle or a carnival game. Is that sounding mostly right? I have that the red team ended up winning this, but I would imagine we have less to say about the challenge and more to say about actually getting to see these people in action.
Yeah, the challenges weren't showstoppers by any means, but I really like just the sheer physicality of this opening challenge. And even small things like having the camera inside the hoop or whatever, so you get this completely different angle of what's going on, and you see the water splashing over it and people tugging it back and forth. Like, all of that was just really cool to see. But what I will not find really cool to see is if there is ever a reward challenge in the near future, I think. On a season like this, where you already have this segment blocked off in for the Edge of Extinction, and you have so much other stuff going on that you want to focus on, like you have more distractions here than on any other season you've ever had, why bother? No one's tuning in for the reward challenges. So I love the idea of combining them, making sure that one challenge for the episode is a really cool and engaging one, and then having that shine and not having like a lackluster reward challenge no one cares about. Waste crucial minutes in this season.
That seems like it may have been slightly over 280 characters, but I would retweet that sentiment.
Yes.
if possible, Dom. And yeah, I'm an idiot. This was a very cool challenge that did not involve a puzzle or a carnival game. Yeah, this was a lot of fun here. So yeah, as mentioned, the red team ends up winning there. And I think, Dom, as we hit these beaches, let's take this kind of...
Hold up, Colin. You've skipped over an entire $1 million here where...
Oh,
yeah. one of the big announcements that we get on that little Sans bit is that we are playing for the biggest prize of all time as well, the biggest prize in the history of reality competition shows, supposedly. Although, is it For Love or Money or something would have something to say about that? I don't know. I'm not sure that's strictly true, but either way, it seems to have passed the lawyer's examination, so whatever, we can run with it.
Jeff Probst exaggerating does not sound right to me.
But apparently that too was also very last minute. Like, even as the vessels were zooming towards that little beach, Jeff was like on the phones with the producers, having to work out is this okay? Like, are we awarding $2 million? And then can we actually say that this is the biggest prize and advertise it as that? So a lot of stuff coming together very late here. This isn't the well polished vision for a season like this you might think they would have had in mind for years and years now.
So perhaps this would play a role in why I skipped over this. And maybe this is a hot take, although I would guess at least some people would agree with the idea that I actually don't think going from $1 million for first place to $2 million for first place is going to change pretty much anything.
Yeah, I wouldn't say surprised by how extreme the reactions were to that. And maybe that's because I do not have $1 million. Like, the idea of having even 1 million that all of them have seems so abstract and large and remote, but there seems to be severe diminishing returns on those $1 million, right? Like, ask Robin Amber this if you need confirmation of anything. Like, once you have the first million, I don't know how much the second million is really changing your life. For all of these people, this would be at least the third million if they were to win that, like that extra that extra second million. So yeah, I don't know. People love money, I guess, Colin. People are greedy.
If anyone would like to donate us $2 million, I think the returns would not be diminishing at this point for either of us. But
oh, I bear in mind, I'm not saying that if I had the extra $1 million, I would just not hoard it entirely for myself. But I'm just struggling to get into their mindset, I suppose.
It just feels to me like you're getting a little too close to saying, who even wants $2 million these days?
It's not about the money. It's about the experience. It's taking part that counts.
I feel like $1 million, what I was getting at is, I feel like $1 million is going to be substantial enough, and $2 million is certainly a nice bonus, but it doesn't feel like that different of a number, even though it obviously is.
Yeah, and look, there are a lot of mouths to feed on the season, a lot of colleges fund to pad out in advance, so I could see the money going a long way, for sure.
Like, if he said $10 million for first place, that I think would change things.
Oh, that would raise the roof, for sure, but even the second million seemed to get them galvanized and ready to go.
What I'm saying is Jeff Probst should give up his next 3 or 4 years' salary to make this happen and see what a real game of Survivor would look like.
I mean, on next, like, 2 months' salary. His salary for next season of Survivor, you know?
Yeah, I don't even... I believe it is out there. I believe I heard at some point that by now the bulk of, or maybe not majority, but certainly plurality of the Survivor budget goes to Jeff Probst's salary. But that's understandable, yeah, after 20 years.
For sure. And it has to be so sick going out there as Jeff, knowing that these poor people in front of you are going to scrap and put themselves through absolute abject misery for 39 days. One of them will walk away with a tiny fraction of your salary for that 39 days, right? You get to go back to your air-conditioned production compound at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dom. So let's get into day one here, and everyone is going to finally hit the beach, and it seems like get right to it. And this is really the moment I feel like everyone's been waiting for. Like, yeah, it was cool to watch them all arrive on the beach and do the champagne toast, but to have them actually out there really playing the game now, I think, and to finally get to see, okay, what sort of relationships are going to develop, it really is like more than any season we've ever had before, I would say, like watching literal Survivor fan fiction come to life. And I think we would be best served talking through kind of the major storylines tribe by tribe, and whatever paths we end up wanting to go down along the way, I would say don't hesitate to bring up whatever seems like relevant to the current conversation. But yeah, sorry.
On that, I don't know if this is relevant to really any conversation, but I had no idea that Jeff was such an Applehead. You know, he seems to be defining the length of time between, you know, people coming back here and their last appearance just in terms of what Apple products were available at the time. It's like, well, Amber, the iPhone was not yet released when you last played back in 2000. You know, it's not like anything else has really happened in the past 20 years that you could use to mark that time, but maybe it's the same way that how, you know, hardcore Survivor fans, it's easy to time events in your life by like what was going on Survivor at that time, like what season was airing. And for Jeff, it seems to be what brand of iPhone had just recently come out, you know, at the time a season was filming.
I wish he had gone like, Nick Wilson, TikTok didn't even exist the last time you had played, and like just gone straight down the line.
Yeah, poverty. Vine hadn't even died yet the last time you played. You know, you could really tie the whole room together.
Oh, Vine was so good, man.
It seemed like you were too old, even at the time, to fully appreciate.
Come on! I was peak Vine. I was right in the mix on Vine, baby.
If you say so.
Yeah. All right. So I think the place to start is with kind of a crossover story. What is this? A crossover season between season 39 and here, where we just saw Rob and Sandra spend 35 days in the snug together, and we got a little snippet of this, I guess it would have been in that opening few minutes that they aired the week before, because I was saying to myself after just the first confessional from Sandra talking about how mad she was that Rob never told her he was coming back to play this time around, I thought for sure that had to be editing magic and they were just taking her out of context and the actual quote was something along the lines of like, I'm mad at him for not telling me Amber would be here. But it seems dumb that Rob genuinely did spend 35 days just straight up lying to Sandra's face.
Which if he did, I don't know that I buy that he did. If he did, it is both a completely asinine decision and absolutely hilarious. the fact that he was able to keep her snowed over for that long, knowing that he would be rumbled on minute one of day one, is just, I mean, even before that in the preseason, right? Like, that's, it's just so baffling to me. But also, of all the people to do that to in the season, Sandra is by far the most spiteful, by like an order of magnitude. So if anyone's going to hold this against you, it's going to be her.
No question. Yeah. And so that's the thing, is as much grief as I have given Boston Rob over all of the years, for sure, I agree with you that if he knew for sure he was coming back out to play again, which I am guessing he must have, like, I certainly haven't had this confirmed one way or the other, but I really bought the idea that he basically was out there for 39 because his appearance fee was so high they wanted to get two seasons out of him, and I would be blown away if Rob wasn't certain that he would be playing on season 40 as soon as season 39 was, or, you know, 2 weeks after season 39 was over. So the following options seem to be on the table. One is Rob didn't know for sure that he was playing on season 40, which I find hard to believe. Option two is Rob did know and lied to her the entire time, which, again, like you, I would find that to be pretty suicidal. I don't see how that could be the superior idea, especially with Sandra as the second party in question. And so it leaves me with option three, and I am open to this being a possibility, even though she's talking this way in confessionals. Is it possible, Dom, Sandra is lying, and this is just her excuse to target Boston Rob and company?
Absolutely, yeah. And in those initial preseason questions, it seemed like Sandra was gunning pretty hard for Amber. Rob and Amber were gunning hard for Sandra. So if there was some breach in that relationship, I think this definitely predates Rob just forgetting to mention that he was going to be on the next season along with her. Like, I think this maybe goes back quite some time. And if, when we see Rob and Parvati team up, which, again, like, I didn't know that was a thing I wanted, but now that it's here, I can't imagine wanting anything else, right? Like, and that's, I think, a common sentiment for so many of the relationships this season, where it's like, any combination of two people. I'm just giddy to see them on my screen at the same time. And if they end up working together, then even better, right? But I think that was born in part from, like, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Sandra and Parvati still have it out for each other. And it seems like Sandra and Romba as a unit were never going to make it work. So maybe Rob and Parvati have to team up for their mutual best interest there.
I feel like, especially in the case of, like, so Sandra and Tony is a good example of this. We've seen them play together on a previous season, and yeah, that was crazy, and it was awesome getting to see them as returnees on, like, a tribe together, but it was game changers, and there was always that kind of thought in the back of your mind of, like, yeah, this is cool for now, but it seems like there is definitely some sort of expiration date on this. Like, there's just no chance that either of these people is going to be left undealt with for too long. But even without other people in the shot, it felt different seeing, like, Sandra and Tony have a conversation, just knowing they were surrounded by all other winners and that it really was this Clash of the Titans season.
Yeah, I remember in, I think it was Game Changers, although it could have been Cambodia, I don't want to mix it up, people who were out there at the time were saying that, like, those first few days felt eerily quiet insofar as you would expect things to be going, like, at warp speed, the fastest they've ever gone in terms of gameplay. But instead, everyone was just, like, cautiously feeling each other out and, like, circling the wagons, waiting for someone to make the first move. And I don't know if we're getting, like, half of the former and half of the latter here, like, a little bit of everything. But yeah, you would expect Tony to be flying off the handle immediately, or Sandra to be back up to her old tricks on day one. And instead, it felt like no one could even put themselves out there to make a decision. And so when we get down to this first vote, it seemed to me, just based on the level zero story that we were told on the screen, that if someone had put themselves out there to say, okay, yeah, let's make up our minds and just vote off Denise or just vote off Adam, then that might have happened. But instead, it's like the fact that no one was willing to commit to everything spooked everybody, and then that kicked everybody into overdrive, and then we somehow ended up with Natalie going home instead, and everyone's left scratching their heads wondering what happened.
I think part of that is probably a function of these being, for the most part, very good players of Survivor, where early on in the game, I'm guessing most of them were happy to just let someone else make a target out of themselves, and when that didn't happen right away, they had to go to pretty great lengths, such as two people going to the water well together to try to put some sort of paranoia out there, or this poker alliance, as we saw on the other team, that Yule now admits wasn't even something he was explicitly concerned about. It was just some reason to have concerns about this group of people who are not us. And it is definitely interesting to watch play out on TV, but in retrospect, I don't actually think it's that surprising that those kinds of seasons get off to slower starts, but then once the first thing happens, everyone's all over the place.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm expecting fireworks for basically every episode going forward here.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess let's stay on this Red Tribe a little bit. I mentioned Tony. What did you think of Tony here, who... You, thankfully, Dom, reminded me at some point along the way in this preseason of a great quote from Tony after Kageyan, talking about how what we saw from Tony his first time was Tony at a 6 out of 10. If he gets to come back and play a second time, we'll see Tony at an 8 out of 10. And if he's lucky enough to come back and play for a third time, we'll see Tony at a 10 out of 10. We definitely saw him come out and hit the ground running really hard in Game Changers, and I wouldn't have been surprised to see him come out here going even harder this time around and really living up to that promise. He got a confessional talking about how he knows everyone's guard is up, and with that in mind, he is on probation, essentially. He's never going to leave camp. He wants everyone to feel comfortable that Tony's not up to any kind of shenanigans. How did you feel like Tony did so far with this new approach, and how much of a surprise was that for you?
I'm just glad he's still here, honestly. I will take however much Tony I can get at whatever level on his gauge he wants to set it to, as long as I get more Tony. And so, again, I'm not going to set my expectations high. I don't know how many more episodes of this we're going to get. And honestly, for as much as Tony was saying preseason that this is exactly what he was going to do, he was going to try to lay low and not be building spy palaces on day one, I'm not sure how much I buy. I think that he is so just restless and eager to go. And we see a little hint of that in the preview for next week, perhaps, where it, possibly Tony's going to get medevaced and answer all of those questions for us. But I think Tony eventually will, you know, those bricks will fall off by themselves. But for now, he seems to be doing a decent job, and I will keep my fist on my on wood as I say that.
Yeah, I am so excited that we are 2 hours through this season and Tony is still there and seemed to stay out of harm's way through this opening round, as far as I could tell. I would be very happy if Tony could continue kind of sitting still for him once we get a little further into the game. But like you, I would be pretty surprised if Tony doesn't talk himself into the idea, whether it is true or not, that there's no real way that he shouldn't be out there making some kind of big move, at least by round four or five or so, which I definitely don't think is necessarily true, but I would have a hard time seeing him just kind of hanging out, ready to go along with whatever the group wants for that long.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. But definitely want to put it out there that ecstatic to keep Tony in the game, whatever it takes, and hopefully can keep that trend going. So the other big story, I would say, on this Red Tribe, Dom, early on, is this Yule and Sophie alliance that we see blossom in the early days and then develop a little further, it seems like, into a bigger group alliance with Wendell and Yule, some of these one-time players coming together who definitely, or at least don't necessarily have the same connections as a lot of the people who've been so involved in the community for so long. I'm guessing you were like me and like all other nerdy Survivor super fans, just ready to pass out as soon as you saw Yule and Sophie team up.
Oh, I loved it. And the issue this season is I have no idea what I'm expecting. And so I have no idea if anything is better or worse than what I'm expecting. Like, is this better than the timeline where Yule and Tyson are just running the game together from day one, or where like Kim and Sophie have some secret thing going on? Like, I don't know, but I'm very happy with the timeline that we seem to be in right now. And this, thankfully, both of them have too much class to give their alliance a nickname of any kind, but we can do that work for them. And so whatever we end up calling this, I'm here for it as long as it lasts.
Yuffie?
Yuffie? Sure. Yeah, let's go with that. Yuffie?
I'm not here for Yuffie, but Yuffie, we'll workshop it. We can do better than Yuffie. Okay. But what did you think of Sophie's confessional talking about how she said, let me find it, I wrote it down, here it is. She said, quote, "I'll never be the smartest person on this tribe as long as I have Yule there talking about physics or whatever," end quote. This idea of like a mental meat shield, or as I saw on Twitter from Jacob Sager Weinstein, a geek shield, Dom. What did you think of this idea in this season in particular?
I think it's very astute. And the idea of a meat shield is not just that you find some guy who's 6'5" and crushing the challenges and you hide behind him for as long as you can. That's only the way it works for the guy who's 6 foot and slightly less of a crusher in the challenges, you know, where on the same axis where you might be a threat, you want to find the person who's a bigger threat and park them in front of you to take the bullets for you. And so if you are defining your game in a different way, or if other people are seeing you in a different light, you have to reevaluate what that means. And so, yeah, for Sophie, you don't want to find, you know, the trans threat to hide behind, or maybe the leader to hide behind. But if people are looking to target the quieter strategists, then Yule maybe is going to be at the top of the hit list before Sophie is. So I think that makes a lot of sense.
What did you think of just the ultimate early game breakdown we saw on this tribe, where we have Sophie and Yule hit it off right away? And as I said, it seemed like with Nick and with Wendell, that was a pretty natural fit, and they all felt really good about each other right away. So we then, on the other kind of half of this tribe, had seemingly this 3-3 split. I think it was Sophie who laid it out in a confessional. It may have been Yule. But I think it was Sophie who said that Tyson, Kim, and Amber are like the cool, pretty people, and Tony, Sandra, and Sarah are like the gritty crew who, as far as I could tell, were happy to just kind of go along with whatever the other four wanted. What did you make of how this ultimately broke down here on the red team?
Yeah, so it does seem like Tyson, Kim, and Amber were just a unit from day one that had to be split up, poker game or no poker game. And then the Tony, Sandra, Sarah block, I don't know if that's actually a thing, if they would even call themselves in alliances with each other, or if that's just they're being lumped together by process of elimination because they're not with anyone else. Because you would think coming into this season, Tony and Sandra would be automatically at loggerheads. Sandra and Sarah maybe too. And then even if Tony and Sarah have this relationship from both of their seasons, you don't know what state that's in coming into this. So I think, if anything, the three of them just got lumped together because they're on the outs, and each one of them independently is very dangerous and not someone you can really count on working with for any length of time. Whereas Sophie, Yul, Nick, and Wendell, whatever you might have to say about any one of them, they're all, you know, pretty smart, stable people, and you can see them just having like a good collegial like alliance meeting or whatever, in a way that, you know, Tony is not going to be able to sit quietly through. Mm-hmm. So I think that all kind of makes a lot of sense. It's interesting to think about Sophie's position in that group, though, because it seems like she is at the core once again. We don't know exactly where Nick stands, where Wendell stands, or even if Yul and Sophie are at the middle, maybe they're at the bottom and Nick and Wendell are the true power couple. But compared to the last time she played, where she had to be managing these egos constantly, right? Her thought was, I have Coach, I have Albert, people who are really going to be firing on all cylinders when it comes to wanting to play the game hard. I can hide behind them and kind of direct their artillery the way I want it to go. And then the other people in the alliance are like Brandon, who's just a hot mess, and Edna, who no one is really respecting and doesn't have any influence. So that wasn't an alliance of equals. It was an alliance of like very mismatched people. Whereas this alliance, it feels a lot more kind of on stable footing. And I don't know if that's because all of them are winners, so there's like an implied equality there to begin with. But like Sophie and Yul is a very different dynamic in terms of mutual respect and everything else from Sophie and Coach or Sophie and Albert, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think that is a very astute observation. And the three that really surprised me, like it definitely tracked with me that Sophie, Yul, Nick, and Wendell would hit it off right away. You flagged up just the Tony, Sandra, and Sarah kind of contingent, potentially just being almost by default lumped together as a trio where they're not part of that one-time player group that is connecting really well early on, and they're also not part of that poker group. It's astounding to me that that triad of players is just kind of the group that is skating by in this tribe, and that they're the group saying, yeah, I'm willing to go with whatever.
For all we know, they might be looking to put hits out on each other, and you know, the time has not come just yet. Like we saw in Tony and Sarah's previous season, Tony was not the first boot there, lest we forget. He was the second boot, where the first vote, it was everyone agreed Sierra had to go, and then the knives were out on the second vote when, you know, things had settled down a bit, people felt more comfortable and more able to try and make a move independently. So maybe that's what we're going to see. Like, we have this easy first vote, but now that that's out of the way, all bets are off and we can mix the game up again.
So I am anticipating, and we will certainly talk about this tribe going to their first vote later on, but if we were to stay in these tribes, I was going to say, I'm anticipating we will probably swap next week, although that's certainly not confirmed, but if we were to stay in these tribes, I guess give me a rough percentage that barring any kind of idle shenanigans, one of Tyson or Kim would leave next.
Oh, so if everything just remained intact as it right. is on this tribe, I could see that. So Yul had said that he actually did want to work with Kim, and everybody in that group knew what the deal was going into that vote, where it's like, okay, we're splitting the vote between Amber and Kim. Amber's going to receive the majority of votes. We're pretty sure Amber doesn't have an idol, and that was part of why the vote was on Amber instead of Tyson, was because, you know, there's just no chance that... you know, Tyson has played several seasons with idols and found many en route to winning, whereas Amber maybe has never seen an immunity idol before in person, right? So it's just a different kettle of fish. And so he seemed to be looking towards the next vote and looking to bring Kim in and try and pry her away from Tyson now that Amber's gone.
Yeah, I would feel very good about any of that quartet being pretty safe if this group were to go back, but I would definitely not be that surprised if they decided now is the time to kind of go a different route here. We've done some damage to the Boston Rob Alliance. Why not nip Tony or Sarah or Sandra in the bud while we have a clean look?
Right, and that doesn't have to be, let's break up that alliance. It could just be, hey, Sandra has won this game twice before and was very dangerous on her third season and is still calling herself a queen. Why not just cut her down to size a bit? Or Tony is, he's Tony, right? He's completely ineffable, unpredictable. Let's nix that right now and remove that variable from the game. Or Sarah was the one person who received the most votes and the most suspicion coming into the season. And for as much as we're saying it's impressive that Tony's still here, it may be more impressive that Sarah is still here, given everything that was said about her before the game even started.
Yeah, that's I definitely did not expect Sarah to be just kind of, as far as I can tell at least, flying under the radar. I'm sure everyone's...
I think she is fully undercover at this point, right? Yeah. Like she's just trying to avoid, she's in plain clothes, just trying to avoid everything. And
she's going from playing as a cop to playing as a criminal to playing as just an average citizen. Don't worry about it.
Right. And according to both Gordon and Dalton, every season there seems to be someone who really has a hard time of it early and just like isn't really engaging with people and needs to like actually hit rock bottom and then rebound to really find their footing in the game. And it sounds like Sarah might be that person this time around. She apparently, early on, in the first few days, was just like keeping to herself, kind of like around the corner from the shelter, not really talking to people, not playing the game hard. So if you see that and you see Sarah is basically checked out, then maybe she is. She moves down your hit list for now.
Good for Sarah, if that's what she's doing. Yeah.
Well, I don't know how conscious it is. It might just be like, oh, hey, I'm really having a hard time out here, or I know that I'm a big target coming in and I'm not adjusting well to that, or I'm missing my family, like whatever it is. I don't know how deliberate it really is, but either way, it seems like she's going to have time to work through that for herself when that was by no means a guarantee a week ago.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm sure we will return to this Red Tribe a little later once they go to Tribal Council in the second half here. Let's head over to this Blue Team camp. Dom, and I referenced this a little earlier, the big initial plot line here that really seems to spark the strategic game is fairly early on, it seems. Adam and Denise go off looking for the water well. Their version of the story is they got lost at some point, either on the way there or on the way back. Obviously, we see that there were certainly meaningful conversations being had along the way here, and in their defense, they wouldn't even deny that. Like, they're open about the fact that, yeah, of course, we were talking strategy, but everyone here is going to be talking strategy with everyone else at some point over the course of these next couple of days. So what's the real harm there? I was right away really nervous because Adam and Denise are two of my favorite winners ever, two people I invested heavily in many of the drafts I did. What did you think of this initial storyline here? Were you buying the idea that this was just a rookie mistake by Adam or Denise, or is in retrospect this seeing that this doesn't ultimately go against them, perhaps just the editors making a mountain out of a molehill?
Well, hey, I could not be happier to see Adam and Denise teaming up. I love to see it. What I don't love to see is them teaming up, distant from the group, off in the woods somewhere while everyone else is plotting against them, noticing their absence. So I don't know. I think this kind of reminds me a little bit of the Aris thing in Blood vs. Border, where he received so much flack for like going off and meditating by himself, when in reality, if people wanted a chance to conspire against him, they were going to find that chance regardless if it's him meditating on a mountaintop or him just going to the water well to refill his canteen for the day, right? And I think maybe a similar thing is at work here, where if, like, Adam seemed to be, like we were saying previously, our estimation of Adam's chances dropped precipitously the moment these tribe divisions came out, because it seemed like this was basically the worst possible for him. And maybe more of the blame lies on Denise there, but either way, if they wanted a reason to target these two, then they were going to find it. And I don't think this one incident really fed too much into that.
I agree for sure. If this is a group of people that was not feeling good about Adam and Denise, Adam and Denise would be major targets, no question. And I definitely do buy that it could be editing magic. They needed some kind of misdirect for what was ultimately going to be a pretty understandable vote in splitting up Jeremy and Natalie, and they didn't want to just dive right into that and make it super obvious. So this was the big decoy they wanted to set up. But at the same time, you know, we talked about how in a group of players this generally pretty good at Survivor, for the most part, none of them are going to want to make the first move. They're going to let someone else make some sort of mistake and then react to that. And if we are still in the state of the game where no one has made the first mistake yet, don't go off to the water well with Adam or Denise. I would say, you know, as much respect as I have for both of these players and as open as I am to the idea that this was all completely taken out of context, if it is indeed the case that this was a big storyline there and they genuinely were on the chopping block for a little bit, I wouldn't be that surprised. It did seem like at least at some point the group was pretty open to the idea of this being a reason to vote them out.
Yeah, if it's not their cards were marked from the outset and it's more just, hey, we need a name because it's day one and we need a name, then yeah, that paints it in a whole new light.
Right. I think this is what I'm kind of getting at, is being the people who go off to the water well is enough for the other people back at camp to just put your name out there no matter who you are. Like, it wouldn't surprise me, whatever, pick two names out of a hat. If Parvati and Jeremy went off to the water well, I could easily see them being the two names that everyone was very eager to get on board with, regardless of whatever else was going on. But thankfully, Dom, it is not ultimately going to be their undoing, at least just yet. Both Adam and Denise going to make it through here, so good news for my draft teams, which I'm sure everyone is deeply concerned about. Let's talk a little bit more about Rob and Parvati teaming up here. What did you make of this? Because of all the things that felt fan fiction-y, this just seemed like impossible.
I loved it, but I don't think it's as unlikely as it sounds, maybe, because coming off of Heroes vs. Villains, Rob was one of Parvati's strongest defenders. He was always saying he would have voted for Parvati if it came down to it. He always seemed to have a lot of respect for her game. And what drove them apart in the early stages of that game was that he just had a more natural alliance assembled around him. Parvati was clearly the biggest threat to him, who could tear that apart from within. And the Russell factor was just hard to ignore. Because you think back initially, it was that big alliance included Parvati and Russell, I believe, with Jerry and Coach on the outside. And it was Russell breaking away, kind of like dragging Parvati with him, her already being on the outs and feeling that she had to just go with whoever would take her at that point, that led them to be their own little block. And then Jerry and Coach were kind of incorporated to replace the two of them. So there's never really been any reason why Rob and Parvati couldn't work together. It just didn't work out the one time they played. And so now they get the chance, and there are so many other reasons for them to do it, then yeah, why not? Let's get this this alliance of all the big threats together.
I guess just in my head, and I'm sorry that this will probably not make a ton of sense to you or many of the people listening, but on MTV's The Challenge, another one of my favorite reality shows, they have people who come back pretty much any season they want to. Many people have played double-digit seasons of that show, and I guess I was kind of anticipating Rob and Parvati, at least potentially, having kind of a Johnny Bananas and Wes dynamic, where above pretty much all else, what I don't want to see happen is you outplaying me. Like, I will take an equity hit on my own game to ensure that you are not the one who is my ultimate undoing.
Yeah, I could see that happening for a lot of pairs on this cast. I just don't see it happening with the two of these guys.
Okay, so I guess that's just the disparity. Is I would have said this may be my number one thought of people who would feel that way about each other.
I don't think Rob is going to be like, oh, I can't let Parvati get me again. In part because I think he still attributes that to A, Tyson's stupidity, B, Parvati having some like weird love complex with Parvati where he fell on his sword to give her an idol and it just all happened to work out properly, and then C, Parvati being so good that she made that happen. I think that there's no like simmering resentment that he's been burning to avenge for the past 10 years. By contrast too, you know, Sandra and half the people on the cast,
they, who
he has some possibly one-sided feud with.
I was going to say, yeah, one name I should perhaps throw into this mix is Sandra probably has a lot of people potentially feeling that way about her.
The other thing, too, is that now that Amber is gone, once Rob sees that, we see him saying in the preview, like, maybe this is Sandra at work here. Like, that's even more reason for Rob and Parvati to team up. If they think that both of their sworn nemeses or whatever has power, then yeah, why not, right? It's almost a marriage of convenience at that point.
One thing that I loved from both Rob and Parvati, and I'm pretty sure they said this individually, is when things were going well for them, and it really did seem like to an almost impossible extent compared to what I would guess they had anticipated in terms of their threat level entering this season, as people were coming up to them just dying to work together, willing to go with whatever they were interested in, they both gave, I think, separate confessionals saying, is it really this easy? Is it me? Am I somehow getting duped here, or is it actually working out this well? And I think that is such a good impulse when you're out there on Survivor. Like, when things are that easy, you should really be questioning it constantly, even if it is always working your way.
Yeah, Tyson was famous for saying way back in the day that, you know, having that experience of being blindsided and then having to go back in your head, relive it time and time again, try and think about what the warning signs were, is so valuable for when you come back and now you know what to look for, and you know what frame of mind you need to be in and when you can afford to have that peace of mind. And so I think that's a useful lens to look at everybody's experiences here coming into the season, where you see Natalie say, as she's going to Edge of Extinction, this is the first time that she's had to get her torch snuffed by Jeff. Like, her season, she was left out of a few votes and so on, but by and large, she crushed it, right? Whereas Rob and Parvati have both kind of been around the block a lot more, and so they've had a full gamut of Survivor experiences, where for Rob, you go back to Heroes versus Villains, he thought he was running the show, and then one vote goes wrong, and suddenly everything collapses from underneath him. And then, you know, you have his winning game, and then you have All Stars, where he's in control, but then there's like this inevitability to him losing in the end. And then Marquesas, where he's just like this brash, cocky young kid who gets blindsided. And then for Parvati, you think back to Cook Islands, where I don't think her getting voted out when she did came as any real surprise, right? Like, she's just getting picked off as the last remnants of a minority alliance. Then Micronesia, she was in control the whole way through. Heroes versus Villains, she was always in danger and never got to feel calm at any point. But now, when she is finally feeling calm and you don't have Russell running around the island scheming and plotting against Rob, and it all seems far too serene for a season of all winners, like, you can understand how this could feel so alien to her. It's just like unlike anything she's experienced before.
I mean, if we think through, I bet Parvati, I certainly don't have the number in front of me, I will ballpark it as her going to 40 to 50-ish tribal councils, at least, over the course of her Survivor career.
That cannot be true, but continue.
Can't it?
Well, if you think about how many tribals are in any given season, right?
She's played three times, and she's made it to day 36 every time.
But unless she's going full Denise Stapley on every single one of those, like, there's no way she gets into the 40 to 50
30
range,
to 40 tribal, whatever.
Either way, I take your point.
She has been to a meaningful sample size number of tribal councils. And I would say, as you mentioned, of course, you know, it was not a surprise to her when her number got called in Cook Islands. She didn't really do anything wrong. Her tribe just ultimately lost out on the numbers because of Jonathan Penner. And then in Micronesia, ran things through the whole way. Heroes versus Villains, yes, under duress a lot, but still virtually every single vote going her way. I would say Danielle DiLorenzo would be the one big exception there, but I can't think of anything else where she wasn't in on the ultimate plan. So in whatever the number is, 30 to 40-ish tribal councils of her career, a solid 38 of them, she has known exactly what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is pretty incredible. We'll talk, I'm sure, later about just how weird it was seeing Kim Spradlin with her back up against the wall. I feel like, was that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that's also one of the few concerns I would have for the Yul and Sophie duo, is that both of them, to their credit, I mean, knew everything that was happening in both of their seasons pretty much. But the flip side of that coin is that if something isn't going well, then that's an entirely new situation for them. They don't really have that precedent to draw on.
Sure. I agree. I think Parvati having so much experience playing from the bottom is only going to be a good thing for her. And even in these situations where everything kind of falls into her lap, to tie it back to the original point, it seems like she's still very good about taking a smart approach and making sure everything is as good as it seems, and being very ready for things to get flipped on their head at any point. So interestingly, I thought here, early on, Dom, we have the whole Adam and Denise drama, but while others are off having some sort of little private conversation, Danny Boatwright, of all people, which surprised me, is, as far as the TV episode is concerned, the first one to throw out Boston Rob's name as a big threat. What did you make of that?
I was a little surprised, honestly, although I think anything from Danny would have been surprising, because she went to such great lengths in Guatemala, Colin. This may be the first time outside of Survivor Guatemala that the word Guatemala has been uttered on Survivor. Danny really doing her best to make up for lost time there. But like for Danny, she went to such great lengths to minimize her own presence on that season, famously not even divulging her own strategy to the cameras, so they had nothing to work with in terms of building her up as a winner. And so now I think maybe she seems to have shed that whole perspective, and she's coming in here a new woman, and basically any player style from her would feel new, because we just didn't get any sense at all of what hers was last time.
And I thought right away that, oh man, Danny, what are you doing? It seems like she's getting off to a bad start here. Ben goes and blows up her spot with a Ben bomb to Boston Rob, and is swiftly owned out of his shorts. But Danny, when Rob goes back to her and says, hey, what's going on? Why I hear you're throwing my name out there? She right away comes clean, and Rob says, you know what? I really respect that. I understand, of course, this is a game where people's names are going to be getting thrown out there. I'm sure my name is going to be coming up at some point from some people. So no hard feelings. And I really appreciate you being honest with me in this kind of difficult, awkward situation right away. Do you want to be in my old school alliance here with Parvati? And apparently Ethan has been brought in on that as well. And it seems like that is one of the bigger storylines here from this blue tribe. So what did you think of this old school versus new school kind of bond explicitly developing in this foursome coming together?
That was pretty fascinating. And even the Rob and Ethan part of that surprised me, because I know that Ethan and Parvati are friends. Danny is friends with no one, and that's how she like got herself in this pickle in the first place, and then very expertly got herself out of it. But Rob and Ethan have beef going back, you know, 15 years. So to see them squash that and work together was surprising, but pretty encouraging too.
Yeah, I would guess enough time has passed there, and enough follow up, you know.
Yes.
I don't want to frame it in terms of someone has won or lost that battle, but like clearly, one was a lasting relationship and one was not. And I am super losing my mind right now, trying to transition into something else. But yeah, so this old school group comes together, which I thought was just crazy to actually see play out. Like, again, I really can't stress, at least for me, this all still doesn't feel completely real. Like, this really just hasn't fully sunk in yet that we get to come in here and do this for the next 2 or 3 months. But yeah, so this old school group was really cool to see form. And then I had honestly forgotten that Jeremy and Natalie were even on this tribe until we hear from Adam that, hey, isn't this Waterwell alliance kind of a small deal compared to Jeremy and Natalie's pre-existing relationship, Rob and Amber's marriage, which I thought was a really good line at Tribal Council. It seems like it was Adam who starts the ball rolling on potentially wanting to split up Jeremy and Natalie. Obviously, that could easily be TV editing magic, but it seemed pretty quick here that Jeremy and Natalie went from totally under the radar as far as this tribe was concerned to pretty easily the biggest threat. So where do we want to dive in on that and how all of this ended up playing out and what it means about power duos and so forth going forward in this game?
Were you surprised by where that vote finally landed? Because to me, I guess it depends on who you think actually was in control of it. Like if Rob and Parvati either weren't in control or they were in control but really wanted to keep their hands clean so that the target wasn't on them insofar as it ever couldn't be, then maybe it makes sense to just let the other people decide. But if I'm Rob, it seems like I want Jeremy there, who could plausibly be some kind of meat shield, who I have that Boston connection with, who it seems like their personalities are pretty compatible. And having Jeremy and Nat, who are not blood, but they are very thick water, I guess, that is one thing that you can point to maybe shift a little bit of the target off of you and your wife, Colin, who is also there in the game with you. So I don't know. It seemed like that would be a natural way to do it. We've seen this in the past where, like blood versus water, Tyson gathers all of the singles together, and then we see you'll use that strategy against Tyson this season, where he gets all of the people who don't have a natural connection, and that's a group. But then we also have seen in the past, like, these pairs just team up and form like this big block. And so I would have kind of expected to see, like, Jeremy and Nat lock on to Rob and I guess Amber by extension on the other team, and for that to be a pretty powerful alliance in its own right.
So the morning after the premiere aired, I released on the main feed a patron episode that I did at some point during this long preseason, drafting against official accountant of the Dom and Colin podcast, AJ Van Gilder, the must not be the first boot of season 40 draft. I will not spoil for anyone who still wants to listen to that where Natalie ended up going in that draft. I will say she was on my team, and I listened back. I didn't listen to the whole thing, but I did listen to hear what I had to say about Natalie in the moment. And this is a direct quote that will fill you in on how surprised I was that Natalie was the first boot. I said, quote, "If she's on Boston Rob's tribe to start, lock her into the merge," end quote. Yeah, I was very surprised. I would have thought that Jeremy and Natalie would make great natural allies for Boston Rob. So this was a major blindside for me. Natalie was someone I was super high on entering this season, and I definitely had reservations about Natalie just in terms of having seen her on The Amazing Race, frankly. But it didn't seem to me like the things I was flagging up as concerns, like namely her potentially conflicting with people more than she should early on, it didn't seem to me like that was the case. It seemed like it purely was just that pre-existing bond with Jeremy that got her voted out. Do we know anything more about other factors that could have gone into this? So, like,
I know absolutely nothing. So I know exactly as much as you do.
All right, fantastic. So, yeah, I'm sure there is way more to this story that they had to leave on the editing room floor. I certainly understand the logic of, hey, Jeremy and Natalie are a really obviously tight duo that is, short of Rob and Amber, probably the closest bond in this entire game. And that is something that we would need to contend with down the line anyway, so why not just nip that in the bud while we still can? At the same time, for someone like Boston Rob or Parvati, I would also understand wanting that threat to be left in the game, at least in the short term. And someone like Adam in particular seems quite appealing in terms of a person to get rid of. Just I would have such an impossible time believing that Adam would ever have anything other than his own best interest at heart at any point.
Yeah, and we were saying before that it seemed like Adam and Jeremy had each other in their sights going into the game, and that definitely panned out. So if you did just want to keep it on one of Adam and Denise, you can do that. You know, Jeremy and Nat would be on board. Maybe the people in the middle would have wanted to sway it one way or the other, but really felt like Rob had the choice to make here, as he's wanted to do, and it's a curious choice. It's not the one I expected from him.
I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm such a big Adam fan, and I'm glad to see him make it through here. But for that reason, I feel like if I were in Boston Rob's shoes, I would rather cut Adam out. I'm much more worried about Adam.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is that I know, so people have made this observation about both of the booths this week that, oh, we're just falling back into that classic pattern of the women being voted out to, like, knock their male alliance partner down to size. And I don't get that interpretation for either booth this week. And I guess we can get onto it more when we get to Amber, though. For that one, it's pretty easy because Rob is literally not on that tribe. You can't vote him out. This is all you can do if you want to hobble Rob. But for Jeremy and Nat, like, we have literally seen a season where Jeremy gets voted out and Nat, to borrow a phrase from Parvati, rises from the ashes and burns your house down. So if anything, I would kind of be more scared of leaving a vengeful Nat in the game, having taken out Jeremy, than I would be of leaving Jeremy in the game after taking out Nat, which I could easily buy that Jeremy could go on a similar, like, story arc now, but it's much less of a sure thing, whereas we know that Nat is capable of doing that. So if anything, it's kind of like giving her too little credit as a player to act like she's not a threat independently of Jeremy. And there was nothing in the episode either to see, like, no one suggested, okay, well, we kind of want to take out Jeremy, but let's play it safe and take out Natalie instead. Like, that, no one was taking that attitude. So it feels like people are really seeing what they want to see when it comes to that.
I completely agree with that. And I also had the thought, like, I think I would be much more nervous about leaving Natalie in as a free agent than I would about Jeremy. Natalie is so much more capable of sneaking through and doing tremendous harm to me down the line, as far as I'm concerned.
I will say, Jeremy did not seem thrilled about it. I'm sure he'll have some choice words and some questions next episode. But
the other thing,
I think I could see Rob managing that, like, doing the damage control better there than with Nat, where I don't think that damage control is possible. Like, maybe she'll play nice with you for a bit, but you know that she's, you know, sharpening the knives in the background while you're not looking.
That's definitely true. The other thought I had in this regard was something we've talked about definitely over the last couple of years, at least on this podcast, and this is going to be way less of a factor on season 40 in particular than any kind of all newbie season for sure, but any other season historically. Like, the pre-existing bonds on this season are unrivaled as far as I can tell. But even with that in mind, you do not want to be the tribe that loses both of the pre-swap challenges and then just is in really bad shape entering the swap to just swap into the minority and be completely at the other tribe's mercy under a ton of different circumstances. And I'm sure this is mega exaggerated because of the way this challenge played out, where in round number two, this tribe ends up getting pretty crushed in the actual team portion of the challenge, and it is Jeremy single-handedly crushing the ring toss that gets them immunity. And obviously I'm not going to say that's going to swing the game in one of their favors, that's $1 million difference keeping Jeremy, but it is certainly a big swing not being the tribe that is going to both of the pre-swap votes.
Well let's get into that quickly. Do you think there's going to be a swap at 18? Because there's no sign of it in the preview, and usually there's a drop your buffs of some kind when that's on the horizon. And also, I don't know if it would make sense for it to be this early in this season, where you have these two great starting tribes. Give them some time to breathe, let them develop, and then maybe when you get down to 16, you can do that. And then the other thing too is that I don't know how having Edge of Extinction in place messes with that timeline, because I don't think we've seen a swap at 18 leading on to another twist like this.
I certainly don't know one way or the other. I guess I'm just leaning that there will be a swap because of all of the most recent returnee seasons that started with 20 people. But just in the preview, you are right that we didn't see anything explicitly saying drop your buffs. But I also was watching it the second time through to see if we saw anything that would rule out there being a swap. And we, as far as I could tell, did not see anything that would rule out there being a swap. So like a challenge, I feel like, would rule out there being a swap if we saw them competing in a challenge as these same tribes, and that was not included. So I think it is I would be leaning yes at this point that we will swap, although obviously would not be surprised if we don't, and I would frankly be interested in seeing them continue to play in these groups.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so I guess let's get into just parting thoughts, at least temporarily, on Natalie. Certainly anything is possible. We are in the post Chris Underwood, perhaps, era where, hey, she's certainly still drawing live. Natalie has proven herself to be plenty competitive in whatever kind of challenge they throw in there for re-entry, and then certainly a capable enough player to potentially get back into the mix there. But Dom, for the time being, Natalie Anderson is our first boot here of season 40. What do you make of that, I guess? Just parting thoughts on Natalie for now.
Very sad, and is almost making me glad that Edge of Extinction is here so that the Natalie Anderson return story is not over just yet. And I don't hold me to that. Don't quote me on that in a few weeks when I'm just wishing we had that precious screen time back. But for now, I can understand and empathize why people want this twist in place, or why Jeff does, at least.
Right. I had a similar thought about, you know what? maybe I'm becoming a bit of an Edge of Extinction fan. I'm chalking that up, at least temporarily, as a coping mechanism, and hopefully I come to my senses later. But yeah, if we have to have Edge of Extinction on one more season, certainly let's make it this one. So Natalie should be, at the very least, a lot of fun over there. Quickly, before we get into her and the fire token bequeathing, I don't know.
Bequest and or bequeathal, I believe.
Oh, okay. Quickly.
Which honestly, on that, I'm not sure why it's a bequest or bequeathal, whereas is it like a requeathal instead of a request? I don't know. Or it's like an inquiry, but it's not an inquethal or an I guess it could be an inquest. There are too many levels there. I can't keep track of it.
I'm going to go ahead and disregard whatever nonsense they taught you at Oxford and just go with bequeathment sound. Everyone knows what I'm saying when I say bequeathment. So that is the new word. But quickly before that, Dom, we see Jeremy, of course, and then also Michelle left in the dark on this first vote. If we don't swap, would you anticipate one of them being the next to go?
I guess so. I don't know which one of them it would be. Like, maybe you follow through, and once you take out Nat, you have to take out Jeremy. Or maybe the easiest move still, if everyone's still finding their feet, is to take out Michelle, which I know you would no longer love to see, Colin, but there are people out there who would be partial to that.
We would hate to see it, Dom. Don't even speak those words into existence. let's get into what happens here this time around on Edge of Extinction. Natalie shows up. I guess before she even gets to Edge of Extinction, she offers her bequeathment. She bequeaths her one fire token to Jeremy, which I don't think we saw anything really come of yet. I guess he got some confessional being happy about that, but just note that one for your scorecards. But more importantly, I would say she gets some sort of note that says you have to earn fire tokens that will either help you get back in the game, or you can buy a full powered idol in the event that you get back in the game. You can spend it on various food items here. She has to go on some kind of journey, which I'm sure for her is nothing after the Amazing Race, around Edge of Extinction. And ultimately, correct whatever I get wrong here, Dom, because it is very possible I did not understand what was happening here. She gets an idol that she then chooses to give to someone on the losing tribe in exchange for their one fire token. Is that correct?
That sounds right to me, yeah.
So she chooses Sandra, and she clarified, I think on Twitter or somewhere, that she would have given it to Jeremy if he had been eligible, but he won that immunity challenge. And Sandra seemed like someone that it wouldn't be easy to trace back to her, and she would cause some chaos. What do we make of this here now with Sandra? Not that it's, hey, Sandra has an idol, but this is how idols apparently work now on this season, is they're just being gifted from Edge of Extinction. What do you think?
Well, you hate to see it, Colin, first of all. But then also, we don't know if this is the only mechanism. Like, maybe, you know, Sandra can stick her hand in a log somewhere and pick up a second idol to go with her first one. Or if if this even is the only route to get an idol, if is this going to be every episode someone faces this choice, or is it only going to be when like there's enough currency involved with fire tokens, or is it going to be staggered so that there aren't too many idols in play at any one time? Although I don't think Probes believes that there can be too many idols in play at any one time. Like all of that is up in the air. So that definitely has a potential to go very, very wrong. So maybe I remember that brief period of bliss in 39 when we were saying like, oh, there are no idols in the game. It looks like the cast is doing pretty well. Like this merge is going to be really exciting. And then everything just promptly turned to shit. So I'm trying to avoid hexing this season by putting that out there into the universe. I'm just saying it's a possibility.
So yeah, I am still reserving judgment overall on the fire tokens. And I am completely willing to leave the door open for this becoming some awesome thing that becomes a staple of all seasons going forward. And this is what saves Survivor and pushes it into the next kind of generation if it is implemented well here. At the same time, I am not yet sold on the idea that that is necessarily what is happening here. And while I am not at all saying, oh, sound the disaster alarm, I am leaving the enthusiasm about fire tokens meter at a 5 out of 10 for this week. And maybe this will be a recurring segment for the early weeks of this season. Right now, my enthusiasm for the fire tokens is about a 5 out of 10, Dom. Where are you?
Yeah, your enthusiasm is not on fire. You would give it maybe half a fire token.
It is curbed. It is decidedly curbed. I mean, actually, this is the wrong way of framing it. My enthusiasm for fire tokens is still like an 8. I think the ceiling is still definitely there. My optimism about the fire tokens is about a 5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So we go into round 2 here, Dom, and we are going to have, thankfully, the other tribe here win this immunity challenge. And I'm telling you, after that first hour, I had a ton of people that I was really looking forward to seeing this season, but when Adam and Denise got off to bad starts, I was not ready for that. I was pulling so hard for them to make it through that first vote. I was thrilled that they did in this immunity challenge. I was screaming at my TV louder than the people on the beach were screaming at their own teammates tossing the rings. I was so fired up during this challenge, and you know, Dom, I don't care generally at all about the challenges on Survivor, but this was so exciting for me. Were you of a similar mindset?
I kind of wanted to see both tribes go in the first episode just to like get a taste of what was going on everywhere. And then also, like, if we follow up Nat getting voted out with just Jeremy getting voted out or something, then that's a little bit anticlimactic for the premiere. Whereas this way, we kind of got a little bit of everything. So I was happy to see it.
And by the way, on the challenge front, as much grief as we may have given Sandra over the years, there is absolutely no doubt that Queen stays queen of third base coaching from the sit-out bench here. Sandra, one of the team MVPs, despite not even participating in this challenge here, where, you know, yelling at Tony and making sure everyone's where they need to be. It was fantastic stuff by her. Although ultimately, yeah. So anyway, Dom, there is your challenge. And just once again, I don't know if I have literally ever been that excited about a challenge on Survivor. And very few challenges even stand out as particularly like memorable in terms of caring too much about who ended up winning. But that one, I was yelling at Jeremy like he was a player on my fantasy football team that I desperately needed to get into the end zone. And thankfully he came through there. So, job well done. And this other team is now going to be going to a vote here. Once again, just as a quick reminder, we are brought back into the Yule and Sophie and Nick and Wendell alliance, kind of having the power here. And I guess where do we want to dive in on how this second vote ended up playing out? Because we've talked a bit already about the Poker Alliance and Yule kind of flagging that up as potentially legit, potentially not, but either way, something people may be a bit worried about. But I guess actually the place I would like to start is with the idea of Amber leaving being not necessarily a direct result of being married to Boston Rob, because it seemed to me like you were alluding to something earlier, like you may have felt that way, whereas I would say it would have been one of Tyson or Kim leaving 100% of the time if she were not Boston Rob's wife.
Oh, no, I completely agree with that. I don't know what I said to convince you otherwise.
Well, when you were talking about how you didn't really see it as being the case that the narrative of, oh, women are being eliminated just by association, they want to weaken their male alliance mate.
Well, what I mean by that is, if it's like a Chelsea and Dean situation, where, you know, like you have both of them there dead to rights and you decide to vote out the Chelsea over the Dean, then maybe that discussion comes up. But when you have Rob and Amber, but Rob is on the opposite tribe, so you can't vote for him, like the only thing you can really do to take a shot at Rob is to vote out Amber instead, right? And, you know, if they were both on the same tribe and you decide to keep Rob around, maybe for other good reasons, I don't know, then okay, is a discussion you can have. But as it is, like, what are you going to do? Are you just going to leave them there because Rob, they're just not on the same tribe for now? Like, that seems foolish.
Okay, I just wanted to... No, I agree that if I were a player out there, I would be very nervous about the possibility of us swapping tomorrow, and Rob and Amber can end up with a good tribe draw right away, and next thing we know, we're at the merge, and we are just completely up against it and down in the numbers.
What did you make of Amber's statement that she felt that being out there with Rob is a disadvantage precisely because they are the closest pair in the game and everyone knows that? And so Amber, on her own merits, maybe would fly under the radar, but instead now she's seen as just this appendage to Rob, where, you know, you have to cut them down eventually, and maybe voting her out is the way to do it.
I agree that it is a disadvantage. I know we talked in multiple preseason podcasts about the idea of it would probably be smarter in terms of sheer just win equity for one of Rob or Amber to just stay home. And I know Rob Cesternino brought up the idea in a recent preseason podcast that if Rob or Amber gets voted out early, it's probably the smartest thing to do to just raise the sail on the mast and leave to help the other person's chances.
Yeah, because the first thing I thought when I saw Amber getting voted out was Rob is going to be furious about this. But then also, this might actually be the best thing that could have happened to Rob in terms of, like, on his tribe, it seems like he's in a good spot. And now, with Amber gone, he's more secure in his own tribe because you know that he can't trust the people on the other tribe anymore. And then also, that overarching threat of Rob and Amber, more so than just Rob himself already being a big threat, that's now removed. So he has a little bit more room to breathe and more room to play, and he doesn't need to hide himself behind anyone else, if that's even possible. So this could be the best thing that could happen to him. However, if everyone else thinks, well, now that Amber is on edge of extinction, any advantage that comes through her hands is just going to be funneled towards Rob, and maybe some advantages will be ending up in her hands, then that becomes a threat of a different sort, and the only way to neutralize that is to just vote out Rob and have that be over and done with.
Yeah, that would be a concern of mine for sure once I found out how idols were coming into the game. I'm going to be really curious to see Rob's reaction when they show up at the beach for the next challenge and he officially sees Amber is gone. He may be tipped off. I don't know when the transfer is done, but if he wakes up the next morning and has an extra fire token in his bag, he may be bracing himself for some bad news. But one way or the other, I'm guessing Jeff is going to give him an opportunity to talk. I'm guessing Jeff is going to be looking forward to hearing what he has to say and giving him as much of an opportunity to talk for as long as he wants to talk, because I'm sure they didn't want this kind of thing to happen necessarily this soon into the season, but I'm sure that Rob and Amber dynamic is something they were hoping to get a lot of mileage out of. So,
And once that process becomes common knowledge on the season, you could see people like opening their bag one morning, seeing an idol, and their heart just sinking through into the floor because they know exactly what that means and what had to happen to make that possible.
I guess that is, I feel like that would potentially be something for like seasons from now, returnees on seasons. Fred, I certainly know what you're saying. I feel like that maybe that's more of like a day 27 kind of situation once they are really familiar with the rules.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Regardless, I'm going to be really curious to see what Rob has to say. And in particular, like, if we do swap or whenever we do swap, I'm guessing we will swap at some point. What happens with Rob if he's still there and the people who kind of led the charge against Amber, because I would imagine it's pretty difficult, sight unseen, for the last 3 or 4 days on opposite beaches to not kind of interpret that as a declaration of war, right?
Okay. Could you say that again, sorry?
Against Rob, like, it seems like them voting out Amber is a pretty blatant message against Rob.
Yeah, and depending on who he attributes it to, like, we see him say maybe this is Sandra's doing, but you could see him like assuming it's someone else and then going on the warpath against them, and then even when they finally get to meet up and that other person can correct the record, it might be too late. Like, maybe all of these plans have already been made to with that in mind.
Yeah, so definitely going to be fascinated to see what Rob has to say and how all of that impacts things on both of the tribes and whatever potential new tribes may or may not exist entering next week. But there goes Amber. I guess, Dom, what else do you have from these first – anything from that second tribal council stand out to you, or anything we skipped over along the way?
Only to say that in that first tribal, apparently there was a lot more whispering and getting up and people going back and forth than we even saw. So that was supposedly very frantic. Adam was the only one firmly planted in his seat, trying to be confident, but getting, I imagine, more and more perturbed as things went on. And then eventually people were talking to him and that was fine. One thing we didn't cover was Ben just getting starstruck, tongue-tied, really making an ass out of himself.
And that's because we're a pro-Ben Driebergen podcast now, right?
Absolutely, and that didn't actually happen, so I'm not sure why people are saying it did. But, you know, I'm reminded of Rob saying to Russell 10 years ago now, welcome to the big leagues, and that kind of blew off in his face in that moment. But this was Rob introducing Ben to the big leagues and being surprised that this underdog even made it into them at all.
I forgot all about Rob owning himself on his way out there. That is pretty funny, though, in Heroes versus Villains. But yeah, I thought Stephen Fishback made a really astute point on Twitter or on the Know-It-Alls or somewhere, talking about how one thing he really liked from this episode is no one got the Dodo music. Like, the closest thing we saw to someone getting, certainly not even close to buried by the edit, but someone even just looking bad other than people going off to the water well. But anyone even like misplaying or something to that effect was Ben really giving it up with absolutely no kind of resistance to Boston Rob. And that was not met with Dodo music. That was met with Ben having an opportunity to laugh at himself in confessional and say, oh man, shouldn't have done that. I got to get my head on straight if I want to have a chance to get back in this thing. And I liked that so much. I love that everyone out there seems still to me like a real candidate here. And I guess this is kind of a nice transition into the edit zone here, Dom, through these first one or debatably two episodes. But before we do that, I will quickly let people know that Dom is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. You can email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com. And for bonus episodes, patreon.com/domandcolin. And the reason I am putting all of those plugs in here right now is for anyone new to the show, we do tend to take a closer look at the edit at the end of the episode. And I know not everyone is in love with that idea. So, Dom, anything before we send it over to the official edit zone, and anyone who is not interested in that can get out of here?
I will say, just on the topic of bonus episodes, we are wrapping up our current rewatch of Survivor China, which has been a great season so far. Looking forward to the ending of that. And then you have the entire backlog of, yes, Colin, hundreds of hours of previous episodes spanning many Survivor Big Brother seasons as well. Yes, it is.
Did you check?
No, I didn't, but I can do basic arithmetic. It's fine. Anyway, moving swiftly on. There's all of that available, and we will soon be deciding what we're going to be covering next. So if you're interested in taking part in that yourself and then having access to everything there, by all means, sign up and get in touch. And then I'm just going to follow up on this this Ben topic quickly, because do you think that lack of anyone being buried was in part due to all of these people are winners? So they come into the season with this air of legitimacy that the random contestant on a random season can't assume for themselves.
I would hope so, although I would not say that necessarily because they are winners, they are thus immune from dodo treatment going forward. I think it is off to a good start, but I would probably be surprised if that continues for most of the rest of the season.
Okay.
Yeah, what did, do you have a strong take either direction there?
No, I just thought it was an interesting topic to bring up.
All right. We'll certainly talk more about the care with which certain people are being edited as we now dive into the edit zone.
You are listening to the Tom and Colin Edit Zone.
Mike Holloway,
Michelle Ken,
Brad Culpepper,
David Goliath.
You are listening to the Tom and Colin Edit Zone.
What are you doing?
Tune out now.
All right, so here we are in the edit zone. I am very curious about the answer to this question. Dom, through the first 2 hours, who is your number one contender?
I see. I should have had that first mover advantage first so I could ask you that question. And then if you didn't answer, it looks like you're the one dodging it instead of me. But I don't know. Which is a good thing, right? Especially for this season. I want to feel like there's always this air of suspense surrounding things. I think Yul and Sophie both look pretty good. I thought Tyson looked very good, given the situation that he found himself in. So my argument for Tyson is that when there was that initial discussion with Sarah and Amber, everyone bonding over their kids and what it meant for them to be out here and the sacrifices and everything, that is a big theme on the season, and that is a theme that resonates for not just so many of the contestants, but so many of the people watching. And Tyson was the one who got the confessional, summing up the group's feelings on all of that and really speaking for everybody there. And then later on, his quote about forfeiting this battle to win the war, I thought was, you know, very astute and framed in a good way. And if he does end up rebounding from these early difficulties, then you know, that's a great thing to put in that montage at the end to sum that phase of things up.
Oh, I mean, any early confessionables about how much you love your family is definitely going to get you some major edit zone points. Definitely on board with Yul and Sophie both looking really good, getting a lot of content, mostly strategically, I would say, but really establishing themselves as big characters, at least early on this season, I think is definitely a good sign. And I would also say, in my top tier, I would probably put Parvati. I thought she had a really strong couple of hours here. She got to talk about her family right away in the premiere. Note that for your scorecards. And just overall continues to look like one of the best players of all time and in a good spot. People seem to be liking her. What did you think of Parvati?
I think she is definitely in there with a shot. Given her reputation, I would be surprised if they didn't try and do something with her. But she's definitely in the mix for me, for sure. I want to circle back to Yul quickly in language that I think he would appreciate. To me, it felt like Yul was out there doing a lot of things, but he wasn't really talking about them a lot. Like the sense I got was that he wasn't explaining himself to the camera all that much. A lot of that exposition went towards Sophie instead, whereas we just see Yul doing things. And maybe that speaks for itself. Maybe you just need to see him being Yul, being very competent, getting shit done and looking good while doing it, seeming to have a lot of class. But I don't know how important that like direct address to the camera really is.
Speaking of language Yul would appreciate, I remember during Ghost Island, and we flagged up preseason James Lim, who was also a management consultant like Yul, potentially suffering from what you described as management consultant syndrome, where everything is in non-confrontational and straightforward terms, and everything's very agreeable, but it also kind of comes across as a bit impersonal because who actually talks like that? And mm-hmm. Yule's confessionals all episode long were cracking me up with just the way he phrases things is so perfect that it's almost like hilarious to me.
Yeah, and so to me that was like just him being eloquent as opposed to him having that specific like McKinsey gene stuck inside him or whatever, which causes people to talk like that. I don't know. I think I said at the time when making that comparison for James, that I think it didn't really apply to Yule, that Yule came across as more genuine, depending on the crowd that he's talking to. And Cook Islands, you really saw that disparity, where I think a lot of the Rero people always saw him as kind of inauthentic, kind of stuffy and remote, whereas the older crowd, the people like, you know, the Beckys and the Sandras, really warmed to that and felt safe with Yule. And I think on this cast, which is the oldest cast on average we've ever had, and where the younger people outside of Michelle, like the Adams and the Sophies, are all drawn to the Yule type, I think his style is perfect. Like you couldn't really ask for a better cast for Yule's style of gameplay and just personality.
Not just cast, but this tribe in particular is just as good as I feel like so many of these people could draw it up. Like Yule is perennially just taking the approach of, well, here's what I'm thinking. Here's exactly why I'm thinking about that. If you have questions or comments, I would love to hear them. And I hope you have a great day and we can continue this fruitful relationship working together. And
There was a good quote on that from his long explanation of his strategy. So, you know,
whole time he's in there like, and again, I know everyone has their own strategies and I'm just seeing what I'm seeing.
Even in the course of explaining his strategy, he was implementing that strategy.
It was incredible.
It was very frustrating. A lot of that was episode specific, just dealing with, you know, the ins and outs of what happened this week. But this quote, I think, is timeless. And if Yule makes a deep run this season, which certainly looks possible, this is going to be a good reason why. Quote, so not item two, influencing people. In general, I try to avoid telling people what to do or being too obvious with my opinions. I found it's usually more effective to share enough information and frame it in a way that will lead to a natural conclusion, but stop short and ask the person for their thoughts and advice. Once they, hopefully, reach a conclusion on their own, I'll agree with them. That way, the person feels a sense of ownership and control, and it's less likely that things will be attributed back to me. And that is... not everybody can or should play that way, but if you're trying to play like Yule, like, that is the way to do it, and he is very, very good at it.
Couldn't disagree more. The way to do it is to yell the same things over and over for 8 years at a time until people get sick of you.
Like that you're the queen, for example, or maybe other catchphrases could be thrown in there, too.
Yeah, so Yule looking really good so far, for sure, and would love to see him make a deep run here and continue to be a main character. Likewise, Sophie, who I thought had a really strong couple of hours. She was someone I was frankly nervous about, potentially kind of getting lost in the shuffle under certain timelines here, but they certainly didn't seem afraid of highlighting Sophie. So feeling good about her overall as well?
Yeah, definitely. And Sophie, by design and, you know, the way she draws it up, is never going to be the biggest presence in the room. She's never going to be the most visible person in an episode, but if she is there delivering her thoughts, that's usually a good sign. Although I think it's easy to be baited by that almost, where she is so good at expressing herself and such a compelling speaker that any Sophie content will look better or more meaningful than maybe it's intended to be. So like, if they're just giving Sophie a confessional, because let's give Sophie a confessional, we haven't heard from her in a while, it's going to be easy to latch onto that and say, great, perfect, classic Sophie content. Like, let's move her up the rankings even further. So I'm trying to avoid getting into that that loop. But I think this opening premiere was really good for her.
Right, and it is not unfair. You know, they've been much better about balancing their ranges overall with the edit. But I feel it is not unfair to still at least loosely be applying the kind of classic Michelle Fitzgerald logic to Sophie in this cast of the all time greatest winners and players and characters that they've ever had. If Sophie is a major character every episode, week after week after week, that's, I think, going to be a pretty big indicator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one person, not necessarily in my winner mix, although certainly did much better than I was anticipating based on all the pregame stuff, but I thought Nick had a really interesting comment about the fire tokens, where he was the one who got to give the confessional saying, I think these are going to be really important, and being good at these fire tokens is going to be the key to winning this game. What did you think about Nick overall? I guess, you know, he found himself in this kind of easy majority alliance after potentially being on a lot of people's radars entering the game. Are you a believer that Nick could potentially run this back?
To me, that sounds like Nick making this heads up move of, you know, that this is a twist that they've introduced and they want to sell to the audience. And if you can be the person who's like embracing the twist and saying that you have figured this twist out, yes, then yeah, you're going to get that attention. I don't know if that's going to be a sign that he actually successfully does that, and that's what helps him win for a second time.
Do you think Nick and Adam have any kind of advantage with the fire tokens being genius super fans?
I don't think so, honestly. I think that's... I would love for that to be true. I don't think it is.
And sidebar, meaning super fans of the TV show The Genius, which I don't know if has come up yet in this podcast, but obviously anyone who has listened to us in the past knows what that is. And Fire Tokens...
We'll reset the board. It has been zero episodes since Colin last mentioned South Korean TV game show sensation The Genius.
Yes. Look at my pinned tweet if you would like more information there, and just go to the link for seasons 2 and beyond, because I believe the YouTube link for season 1 is dead, but you can still find all of the seasons in that second link. And if you have not yet seen The Genius, I don't even know what to do with you anymore. I can't believe that you have even made it this far into a Survivor podcast. But either way, here we go. How about Ethan Zahn, Dom? He seemed to at least be present and looking good. I don't know what I would expect out of an Ethan Zahn winner edit in the year 2020, but this wasn't not it.
Yeah, if Ethan wins a season, the skies will open up and he will literally ascend into heaven. so prepare for the edit to reflect that. And so far, it's been, you know, very positive. No one, of course, would have anything bad to say about Ethan. But I don't know if he does go on to win, if it's just going to be like an absolute coronation where it's never even in doubt.
I'm going to move on to the, dare I say it, tier of players here.
Okay.
Who...
Do it.
It's still hard to talk myself into there being many winning timelines for these folks, but based on the premiere, I am certainly nowhere near done chaining Boston Rob, Tony, or Sandra. What did you think about it? Any of the three of them seem promising to you?
It's been one episode. I would be highly reluctant to dun chain almost anyone. I will say, though, I think Sandra was painted in like a very narrow light this episode, where it's just, okay, I'm seeking vengeance on Rob. And you would think if she goes on to win for an unprecedented third time, like that is the most historic feat in the history of reality TV, maybe, then you would expect more from her from this opening episode.
I would... I feel like this wouldn't be inconsistent if Sandra won again. I feel like in the case of Sandra, the mere fact that she has already won twice is all people ever need to know about. They're not going to forget about that. So just the fact that she's there looking good, looking in the loop, seeming really capable with this idol that has come into her possession now, I am definitely feeling better about Sandra than I think I would have expected to after the premiere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right.
And then we didn't see too much of like Michelle or Sarah Lucina or Wendell, anyone else that was on your rate, Danny Boatwright. We saw, I guess, looked first really bad, then really good. Anyone else hopping around the lower visibility tier for you that you feel like we should keep an eye on?
Noah Bendry, Broken Redemption arc in the cards for you?
Maybe. I mean, people remember who he is.
And that's actually something that, again, happens a lot, right? Is the winner has this stumble early, you know, like, no example immediately comes to mind, but there are many. Just take my word for it.
Nick.
And, well, yeah, Nick would be a great one. And often they
go on.
How
about Chris Underwood?
Sure, we'll throw him in there too. So yeah, I think it is a fairly common trope, and I'm definitely not disqualifying Ben by any means. And again, like you said, it would be so easy to just attach that Dodo music to him, but he was safe from that. So maybe that's a sign.
Well, hang on. Along those lines, I meant to bring this up earlier, is what do you think about Denise and Adam potentially being made to look like they got off to a bad start?
Yeah, that definitely harms their chances, but I could see the same thing just applying to them, where one mistake in the first episode is not going to be the death knell for anyone right. just yet. So there's also that whole group of people in the middle who are fairly quiet, like, maybe Sarah's going to go on to win again, and this is just a quiet start for her. Or, you know, Wendell is just chilling out and relaxing for now, and that's fine. That's what he has to do. So I think it's going to be another few episodes for sure before any real front runners start to emerge.
Yeah, I guess I just feel like I was remiss not to bring up specifically Adam earlier. I would not put him up in the Yule, Sophie, Tyson, Parvati kind of tier, but Adam for me is a pretty compelling person after this first episode.
Okay, a compelling losing finalist perhaps?
we'll see. Okay. It would be funny if, like, Adam and Jeremy are unanimous losing finalists to someone after winning unanimously their first time.
I'd be here for it.
That'd be great. All right, Dom, anything else? Any small things jump off the screen at you? Any theories about whatever it was, the snake and the turtle, or what were the animals that were...
Oh, the crab and the snake, like, locked in a battle to the death?
Yeah.
That was really good. I hope that this is the best season of all time for the animal imagery too. I hope that they really raise their game in that department as well.
I believe I heard that they do not even, like, go get their own animal imagery. At least in many cases, they just, like, buy it from National Geographic and insert it into the Survivor episodes. But I'm sure it is definitely the case that some of it is filmed on location. Yeah. But I don't know how many new animals they're finding after, like, 5 years in Fiji or whatever. All right, Dom, I think that is enough here for week one. A lot of fun going through all of this. And it's pretty annoying that these next 13, 14 episodes are all going to be 1 hour long. I guess we'll probably get a double week in there at some point, but I am very much not looking forward to hour-long episodes. I wish every week could have this much to talk about.
Yeah, I think I'm good, and I mean that in every sense of the word. Like, this was a great premiere, lived up to my expectations, exceeded them in a lot of ways, and honestly, for the past year, talking about Survivor every week has been a chore at times, and I've been traveling and been out of town a lot, and often, if I find myself missing an episode of doing this for 38 or 39, it didn't feel like a tragedy, honestly. Whereas this season, you better believe I will be going out of my way to be here every single week, because I have high hopes for this season, and so far it's absolutely lived up to those.
All right, change of plan. I'm going to take the next 3 months off, and you can do it with whoever you want.
Give me a taste of my own medicine. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. No, very excited to find out what we have in store next week with either episode 2 or 3, still unclear at this hour. But we will, of course, be back then to break everything down. Until then, one more time on Twitter at DomHRV, at Colin Stone, patreon.com/DomandColin for bonus episodes. As Dom mentioned, wrapping up China right now, and then on to something non-Survivor after that, some sort of Big Brother the Mole-esque kind of thing that could be a fun little side project, as we have this and also Australian Survivor All-Stars also happening right now. Definitely do not have time for regular coverage of that, but we will definitely make an effort to get in here at some point and definitely talk through that as well, because that has been a ton of fun. Well, I say that. Dom, have you been watching that?
I have, yeah, and that's getting off to a roaring start as well.
Okay, good. Well, maybe that will happen in the not-too-distant future. Until then, have a great, I guess the weekend's almost over, but enjoy the rest of the week until the new episode Wednesday. Take care, everybody.